Hello.
Keith?
Oh, you got the video app.
I don't know what the fuck that is. I didn't click on nothing. How did that happen?
I don't know. I got the full view. Put your clothes on.
How do I stop that shit?
I don't know. I think it must be part of...
the new Skype?
Yeah.
I'm naked. Damn it. You can see my wonder staff.
That's not where the microphone goes.
How do you turn off video? There it is.
There you go.
All right, technology at its best.
I don't have a camera set up, so if you can see me, I don't know how to fix that.
I see you at a bar, I think. There's a picture of you at a bar.
Yeah.
With your beet burger or something like that.
Bloodshot eyes.
Eating something vegetarian.
Yeah, I don't even know what my picture is right now. It used to be me and my Star Joes.
It looks like you're... Well, I don't know how to enlarge the photo. It looks like you're at some kind of buffet or something. I don't know. Wearing a hoodie.
Nice.
But it's like microscopic. I can't see it.
Gotcha. So that was funny. All right, this is episode 23.
Yes.
Retrocast.
That's what I got.
Live and video.
Video cast. All nude.
Wonderstaff version.
Yeah. I thought I'd at least show you my Wonderstaff before I hit you with it.
It's good to know what's coming. Wait. Bad choice of words.
Yeah.
It's like a preview of the future, you know, and like 20 years from now when we do this, it'll be virtual reality and we'll be sitting in couches in some virtual space, and when you listen, it'll be like sitting with us.
Yep, you'll be in my brain.
Yeah.
Maybe while you're in there, you could fix my ear.
You'll have a cybernetic ear by then.
Yeah.
Part cyborg.
I'll look like Jonah Hex by then.
like, what's the name of that futuristic Jonah Hex?
Yeah.
Was it just Hex? Is that what it was called? Yeah. Jonah Hex in the future. 2099. But yes, this is the conclusion of our long-term coverage of the fourth world.
Yeah, did we start that? Like, I don't know, maybe really early on, right? When we're in single digits?
Definitely in single digits. It might have been far back as episode 2. I know our first episode, we just talked all our own random comics that we had read. I know we didn't read anything advanced, but it could have been as early as episode 2 or 3. Because you consider it's got to be around 50 issues of the comic, right? Because you had four different series going. Three of them went to issue 11, and then Mr. Miracle went a little bit beyond that. So.
And then we took a break and we did the Flash Chronicles volume.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, we had a couple episodes of that too, so. Yeah, it feels like an accomplishment.
Yeah, it's sad.
Cover the whole thing.
It's over.
Yeah. Everything must come to an end.
Yes, it must.
But yeah, you mentioned your ears, so since the last time we recorded 2 weeks ago, is it about the same?
Yeah, it's about the same, except there's weirdness going on. Like yesterday we got a flat tire. We went to Buffalo Wild Wings and noticed the tire was totally flat, and drove it to Firestone and to get it replaced. And we went to go see, because it was, they said, oh, it'll, worst case, it'll be ready in 3 hours, like right before they close. So we were like, God dang. And then we looked at the movies and what the start times were. And we were like, wow, we could go see one movie, and it was Anchorman 2. Barb hadn't even seen Anchorman 1, but we were like, well, it'll kill, you know, 2 hours of time.
Yeah.
And then we could go on. And it's a brand new theater, like totally digital, and new speakers and digital surround sound. And man, my ears were like hypersensitive. Like, it was weird. It was like me before would have loved the surround sound, right? Mm-hmm. But me now, it was really like, it was painful. It was painful sound because it was coming in so loud. And I don't know what my brain's doing to try to beef up the sound or whatever, the tones. But luckily I have Barb. Barb keeps earplugs in her purse for me. Mm-hmm. And I put an earplug in both ears and was able to hear both, you know, the whole movie through my left ear. I didn't put it all the way in my left ear, but I put it all the way in my right because it's become really hypersensitive to loud noise. But I could hardly hear any, like, voice. I mean, I can if I really concentrate, but
yeah,
it was weird with the speakers. But then again, we went to go see at an older theater, Hunger Games, and it worked pretty good. Like, I didn't even need the earplugs for that. So it was weird.
Must have had something to do with the intensity of it or something.
Yeah, I was like, Barb, is it loud? And she goes, is it really loud? She said it's really loud, but, you know, she wasn't an excruciating, like, I felt like I was the $6 million man and somebody was hitting me with some, well, actually, that's the bionic woman, right, that has the ear. It was like Count Vertigo was hitting me with something.
Crazy.
Or Sonar from the DC universe. It was like I was Green Lantern and he was blasting me with his gun.
Yeah, well, hopefully, I don't know, Dyson, are you feeling like this is where you're going to be at?
I don't know, it's hard to tell.
Yeah.
I'm used to it, though. I would like the tinnitus to go down a little bit, but
right.
I can live with it. I can function as a human being.
Yeah, it'll probably be easier to function.
I think I'm getting some hearing back, and that's causing my brain to do weird things, if that makes any sense.
Hmm. Yeah, I think the hearing loss would be easier to live with than the tinnitus.
Yeah.
You know? Because that's just irritating. But, well, seeing as that it is the grand conclusion, should we start with the fourth world this time?
Sure. I thought it did a really good job of, like, I don't know what the duration of time was between number 6 of the New Gods reprints and this one.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it did a really good job of taking off from the previous issue we just read.
Yeah. Yeah, I think they were at least around the same time, I think.
Oh, the last issue, Orion fell in the fire pit and they couldn't find his body.
Yeah.
And this issue, kind of see what happens from that point on.
Mm-hmm.
And he was there rescuing his mom, Tigra.
Yeah, I saw that you mentioned that you had read the afterword as well, which I mentioned now just because it provides a little bit of nice context to this, that this on the cover, when it originally came out, was a $5.95 book, just about $6, and it's listed as graphic novel number 4, you know, when graphic novels were enough of a novelty that DC was actually numbering the ones that they had put out. But Mark Evanier in his afterword talks about how, you know, Kirby was offered this opportunity to finish up, or sort of at least give a little bit more of a conclusion to the Fourth World Saga, which it seems was, of all the work that he was doing at DC, he really took the Fourth World and the New Gods pretty personally, that it meant a lot to him. So, you know, it's not so much the final work, as you read the final work, it's not so much that he brought everything to a definitive end, but I feel like it closes the chapter. You know, it definitely works as an ending while leaving some, you know, the characters around for people to pick up later and use. But I felt it overall, it's just an overall statement. I felt that it was a satisfying conclusion to the, you know, at least the Dark Side High Father Orion kind of storyline.
Yeah, I agree. It was a satisfying conclusion. It was very interesting though, because Mark Evanier kept saying that through the course of the New Gods, he kept changing his mind on what the ending would be over and over again. And one thing he did know is that he wanted to have the finale have the death of Orion and the death of Darkseid. But during this time, DC had given him a pretty good check to use his Fourth World characters in the Kenner Superpowers collection. Mm-hmm. That's why you had, you know, Desaad and Steppenwolf and all of the, you know, the Parademon and Mr. Miracle and all the different characters.
Yeah.
Darkseid. And they grew that world. And at that time, he couldn't kill off the characters because they were growing in the toy popularity. And they had visions for them. And he had even left for Marvel for a while. It talked about that, like, during this time, like, he got Demon and a Commandy going, and then he left for Marvel. And during the time when he got Demon and Commandy going, his whole intent on all of these books was to jumpstart him and then hand him off to another creative team and then move on to the next project. I think that was like his vision. Like he wanted to be the visionary for these projects, kick them off, get them started, and then move on to the next one and then envision something brand new. So it just says that his mind wants to be constantly creating. That's where his choice, what he wants to be doing. It's creating new worlds, creating new characters, and then moving on to the next thing. And I guess he received a phone call, and it was DC saying, you know, because it also is interesting during this time that DC was, sales were going down the toilet. Most of the titles were bi-monthly, and it was very rare for things to be monthly, and they did launch Commandy and Demon in a monthly format. And they wanted him to focus on Demon and Commandy because the initial sales for those two books were pretty good. They were decent, and they liked the sales, and then dropped the Fourth World books. And that was like devastating for him because he didn't want to drop the Fourth World books.
Yeah.
Mark Evanier said it was like when he came into the room and told everybody, it was like there was somebody had died. You know, he was saying as the death of, and that I think that bittered him towards, you know, DC for a bit, and then said, well, I'm going to go back to Marvel for a while.
Yeah, definitely. And that would have been the time period where he did Devil Dinosaur and stuff like that.
Yeah.
His last period of time at Marvel. But, yeah, his career definitely took some interesting paths. And, you know, it wasn't a given for a while there. It's, you know, that time period in between while he was at Marvel. And it probably looked to a lot of people as if there wouldn't be a real, you know, we wouldn't get to see how Kirby would have ended things. I think for a while people didn't really maybe lost hope a little bit that they would ever see something like the Hunger Dogs. But, you know, it was when they actually started to have a conversation about him doing it at DC. Originally, he wasn't really given enough space to tell a coherent story, and it was kind of funny to read that the editor was really nervous and reluctant and tried to get Mark Evanier to tell him that they found it to be a little bit incoherent. And, you know, Mark Evanier didn't really want to be the one to do that or be involved, and refused the offer to do some rewrites on it. So finally the editor worked up the courage to go and actually meet with Jack Kirby at his house and tell him. And when he told him, it ended up not being that big of a deal. Kirby agreed with him and told him, you know, made the point that that's the whole reason he needed some more pages. And that's seems to be where the idea came about to actually make this a graphic novel. And so, you know, Kirby took the pages that he'd already made and reworked them and added more pages to make it more coherent. So when you're reading it in the omnibus, some of the pages fit the full pages of the omnibus, and those were, I think that those were the originals. And then there are some that have a little bit more of a margin on the bottom of the page. And that has the reason for that has to do with the expansion of it from a single comic issue to a graphic novel. I don't know. I personally didn't find it disruptive.
I didn't either. I noticed it like initially. My mind, because I read the afterword after I read the book, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I noticed it initially, and I'm like, why are the borders so big on the top and bottom? You know.
Yeah.
And then once I got into the story, like, it didn't matter that they were there, and I failed to notice that they were there after, you know, one or two pages of it. And then I read the afterword, and I'm so, oh, that makes sense. You know, there was a lot of discussion at the time whether they even put it in the volume and re-release it as a large graphic novel so it would look, so the pages wouldn't be squished, you know. And I guess they, so... That is an interesting thing. If you go through the book and just read it as a 22-page comic, if we'd find it coherent, you know.
Yeah.
You know, count the pages. Is that 22 pages? You know, why how these all fit, and then see if it was coherent or not. Because a lot of the pages had the margins. So
yeah, and a lot happens. I don't know. I can't imagine it was. Just seems like it would be way too condensed, you know.
The other thing that was interesting in the afterword is it talked about, it didn't get into a lot of detail at all, other than mention that during this time Kirby's art style was changing a lot, and the Evanier mentioned that he was having a hard time getting back into the fourth world, and that he was having a lot of health problems at the time too.
Yeah. Yeah. It was so, so used to being in the present and just dealing with whatever was in front of him. And, A lot of the things that had inspired him initially, I found it interesting that his feelings about President Nixon had in part informed his characterization of Darkseid.
Yeah, that was very interesting.
So that, you know, going back and later and trying to reconnect to that initial inspiration and you know, and whatnot, was a little bit of a challenge for him. But I also read the afterword afterword. I read the afterword after word. So yeah, I didn't feel that though. You know, it seems I feel like he got past those challenges. I didn't really notice that. I mean, reading it, I would say with this and the new addition to the New Gods reprints that we talked about last time, I would say that the most noticeable difference is just in the art, not being bad, but looking a little bit different. And you also do have three different inkers in the Hunger Gods. I mean, Hunger Dogs. I knew I was going to do that. And again, that goes back to apparently the, you know, the fact that they had added new pages. And I found that a little bit noticeable, but I didn't so much notice the inking as I did the lettering. There's a little bit of a difference in the lettering on the new and the old pages.
I didn't notice it at all, to tell you the truth.
I noticed.
I thought it was of a size thing. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because as the page got smaller, I thought it was just more condensed. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not a distracting difference. It's a slight difference. So.
And you wonder if like the underlying theme is, it seems like Apocalypse is doing a shift in the way Darkseid used to rule, and it seems like it bothered Darkseid somewhat. Like, as technology and weapons started to change, Darkseid's like rule through fear also started to change. But it seemed like he had this undertone throughout the book, like he didn't like the change, if it made any sense. I mean, at least that's what I got. As he was talking to his, you know, technologists, they're like, oh, as these Hunger Dogs are trying to raid this, let's just use this weapon. and he it seemed like he had this tone like, you asshole. you make everything so easy or something like this. It's like,
yeah, I almost got a sense in that regard of him being a ruler that's sort of toward the end of his time.
And you wonder if, like, his health, you know, he was writing a little bit of himself into it. I don't know. You could speculate all you want, but
well, I can definitely see that. Like, it feels a little bit like he's out of touch with his time, you know. You know, obviously other writers would pick up Darkseid and use him and many different times after this, but as far as Kirby writing Darkseid goes, you know, this would be the last time, so it feels a little bit like he's a ruler that's sort of at the end of his time and has a lot of fatigue that comes up a lot of times when someone is in charge for too long, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, the Hunger Dogs, the name of the graphic novel refers to basically the common people.
An apocalypse,
yeah. That over time, you know, the masses rise up kind of have had enough. And we see a lot of them starting from the beginning that are starting to get unruly and are starting to get sick of Darkseid's rule on Apocalypse. And as you said, there's new technology, and the primary new technology that gets highlighted throughout is something called the Micromark.
And it's interesting there was a little bit of confusion on how the Micromark got there, but there's that little boy that was introduced many, 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 many issues ago in New Gods that kind of turned into a monster.
Mm-hmm.
He was like an assistant to Mentron. And maybe you can explain that part to me later, because I got really confused on why he shifted sides. Mm. I didn't understand that.
Yeah, well, do you want to just sort of go through it and get there?
Yeah.
As I said, some of what the soldiers in Darkseid's forces call the lowlies, or, you know, we refer to as the hunger dogs. As you said, there's this sense that technology and robotics and whatnot have become the order of the day for Darkseid's forces, and they even talk about for some reason there was it almost seems as if there was a mistake that a live sentry was posted at one of the gates, and the hunger dogs kill the sentry, and we check in with Darkseid, who, as you said, seems to have some issues with all of this technology being used, and insists that it's fear that rules the cosmos, that no matter what, no matter how much technology they use, that it's still, you know, he still relies upon fear instead of technology to keep people in line.
And I even thought this one, you know, lieutenant or whatever he is that's working for him, I thought Darkseid was going to kill his ass until he started mentioning the anti-life equation. It's almost like he was smart enough to vector Darkseid's hate away from him for a bit.
Yeah, it's an interesting exchange, because we've definitely seen exchanges before with Darkseid and his henchmen where it's gone that way. So it's interesting that this guy does survive.
Yeah.
We have two really dense pages with a lot of small panels that cover this conversation. And then I thought it interesting that we flip over to the next page and it's just a large splash page of Darkseid's face. And it's an interesting concept, because he talks about how, well, what he says is the risk is in the corrupting of the virtuous, because virtue has a bad habit of coming back. And what he's referencing is his soldiers' plan to bombard New Genesis with all of these different technologies like toxins and poison sprays and all of this stuff. And, you know, Darkseid's sort of prophetic and saying, you know, that's all well and good, essentially, but the risk is that if you end up corrupting the virtuous, then the virtuous that you corrupted will come back and use your tactics against you.
And that's exactly when you see Orion pop back up.
Yep.
He's burnt, and, you know, from the fire pits, and Hyman somehow grabbed him. Did I just say Hyman? Hyman?
Yep.
Hyman grabbed him out of the fire pits and is helping him. And
I was excited to see Hyman back.
Yeah, it's actually pretty cool shit, because he is a master of technology, and he is like the He's like the rebellious scientist that goes against Darkseid. Mm-hmm. And he's there to help Orion, and he knows Orion's going to heal fast, and he like scares the rest of the Hunger Dogs away because I guess he doesn't want them to know.
Yeah. And he gives Orion a mother box too, as you know, Orion's been in the habit of doing all of this time. Change his appearance to look more classically handsome, and it turns out that he is he's in love with Hyman's daughter Becca.
Yeah, and that's the first time I think we've seen Becca.
Yeah, I think she's a new
and character. Nobody knows about Becca because Hyman has managed to keep her a secret, at least from the people that would try to hurt her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you get the sense that's all Hyman's really got at this point. You know, this whole Micromark thing, it seems to it's not completely clear to me, but it seems to be connected somewhat to the anti-life equation.
Yeah. Actually looks like actually looks like a bomb, but it's just part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And they take this little cylinder and they put it into like this bomb related thing. And then this is how they were gonna attack New Genesis, is they were gonna put bombs throughout. And then Hyman managed to teleport himself in and take the bomb away from Darkseid.
Yeah, I like this because he phases in, yelling, "Phase in!" And, you know, he just kind of rockets right into the room, grabs the bomb, and I guess rolls with it. So it's just kind of like it's kind of a funny sudden move on Hyman's part. But then they have him and Darkseid have an exchange. Where are they?
the minions in this of Darkseid are pretty badass. Like, they're so confident in their technology that they're like have an answer for every time Darkseid's ready to kill them.
Yeah,
it's like, hey, don't worry about that, Darkseid. We got the automatic destruct button right here.
Yeah, they're you know, Hyman seems to be pretty pleased with himself, and he disappears just before one of Darkseid's guys is going to smack him in the back of the head with this club. But apparently Hyman's technology is pretty outdated, so his people are able to just pretty much follow the trace of his phasing to exactly where he goes. So, as you said, you know, their technology, and you get kind of almost a sense that we're so used to seeing Darkseid as the one, like, he's still in charge, but in the past he's always been the one to be setting all the schemes and arranging the, you know, his, whether it be Desaad or Mantis or whoever, he's the one that's moving them around like chess pieces on the board. And this, it's as if he's still in charge, but it's the people that are surrounding him now that are the ones that really know what's going on and know how all the technology works. And they're presenting it to him and telling him about it because he's technically in charge, but it's not him that's initiating. It's not him that really understands the technology.
And that's why I'm thinking that he wrote some of himself into this, because as time was going on, like, back in the day in Marvel, when it was first launching, Jack Kirby could call his own shots. He could guide anything he wanted because he was creating the whole Marvel universe.
Yeah, and
now he's at DC, and his technology is changing and tastes are changing, right? I mean, people mm-hmm. are looking at different types of artists and stuff. He's sitting back and looking at this, and I don't know. There's just too much to read into it, but it seems weird. Like, I know they said that he put a lot of Nixon into it, but I wonder if he had put similar situations that he was dealing with into Dark Side.
Well, yeah, and I think at this point, you know, Nixon's gone, and you know, it said that was kind of his inspiration earlier on in the 70s when he was writing it originally, but I think he had to find a new way, new inspiration. And Avenir does say in the afterword that Jack always put a lot of himself into his writing and his characters and stuff, and I don't think it's much of a stretch at all. I mean, like you said, you had a time when Jack was totally in control, as it were, and new artists that came into Marvel were told to emulate Jack, and he was the one who evaluated their work and showed them how to work fast and get the job done like he did. And by this point, as you said, the taste had changed. People were looking at the stuff that he was turning in, and it was out of fashion for a time, you know, because it was, I think, at that time associated with what had gone before, and you needed some more time to pass for people to look back and for DC to start issuing all these Kirby hardcovers and all that kind of stuff, you know, for people to appreciate it again.
Right.
So I can definitely see that. So
So these minions did exactly what they said. They traced the device to where Hyman was, and as soon as they knew where to find him, they hit the button to disintegrate that.
Mm-hmm.
And you have an evil laugh. Meanwhile, on New Genesis, they're throwing some of these weird-looking creatures to attack New Genesis and Lonar, who we kind of seen in backups. He was on his horse, and he's kind of discovering places on New Genesis that are were devastated, and how the old gods went away and were replaced by the new gods. And I guess he's like, he was still doing that, and then he's called forth by Highfather. Mm-hmm. And he brings Lonar here, and it's a dire emergency because they know. Highfather knows what's happening.
And yeah.
I don't know why he chooses to do what he does, because I think he knows how to avoid it, or at least attack back, but we'll see later what he ends up doing. But he needs Lonar to help with this situation.
Yeah, you get the sense that you know, the Highfather, unlike Darkseid, he's always been kind of in the background and somewhat letting things go their course and just trying to protect his people amidst. He's never been one that's really advocated direct action, and that's kind of why the Forever people in their series ended up going off and doing their own thing, because they were critical of Highfather's passiveness. But yeah, I was surprised to see Lonar show up and be used here, but I did find it effective seeing, you just get like at this point sort of one panel of New Genesis, the floating city, and whereas we've seen it so many times before, floating over this lush, beautiful world, we see that the land has been pretty desiccated. There's not a lot of vegetation, and there's bones of dead animals and stuff. So it's pretty, it was pretty effective to see that. And then using technology, there's a replica of New Genesis that Highfather shows Lonar, and there's these spots that look like disease where that are referred to as infected areas, and that's where they've tracked that these bombs that we've seen on New Genesis have been placed. And then we run into Light Ray for the first time in this graphic novel.
Yeah, and the one thing though that happens during that, you know, while he's showing that map, is the a boom tube actually comes in and the guy throws the bomb
at
Lonar and he catches it.
Yeah. One of the same, looks like the same kind of bomb that that Hyman stole, this kind of pink futuristic box. But yeah, you know, I find it interesting that he did this in the new part of the New Gods reprint too, where Light Raid looks just like Human Torch when he's flying, using his powers. He really kind of reminded me. It's almost as if New Gods took place in the Marvel Universe, could be the Human Torch or something. The way that he's drawn, like in red and all just like black streaks.
Yeah, when he's going at hyperspeed.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I thought it was kind of interesting that Light Ray, when he heads towards Apocalypse, he's surprised that no parademons have, you know, he says, where are the perils of yesteryear? Once again, putting forth that idea that there's been a change in the regime, at least what the regime uses.
Yeah, it's almost like they've traded away manpower for technology, right?
Mm-hmm.
In other words, like Granny Goodness would train all these parademons and killer furies, and now they just have these minions who are making technology to go after their enemy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, we saw Darkseid bringing some of those people back to life, Kalibak and Desaad and stuff, but they were brought back as kind of mindless zombies that you could control. And at this point, they've foregone even using like organic life. It's just a lot of technology. But Light Ray does get into Apocalypse, past this barrier that they've created instead of parademons, and comes into contact and finds Orion.
And he's very glad to see his buddy and introduce him to Becca.
Yeah, it's funny, they actually kind of roughhouse a little bit. Like they wrestle a little bit. Light Ray kicks Orion in the ass and knocks him over. But the fun doesn't last for long. There's a because as we know, their hidden location here has been found, so a big green robot shows up, smashes its way through the wall, but Light Ray is able to deactivate it for a minute and open it up and reprogram it, and they send it back out into the masses to track their way to wherever you know, the stations that Darkseid's operating out of.
Yeah, in the past you'd have a parademon smashing through it. Now it's all these techno robots that look kind of like apes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's definitely a. And we keep referring to the era of Micromark. Keeps getting brought up by Light Ray and Highfather and stuff. You know, this new seems to be the new kind of catch-all term for what Darkseid is doing.
And Orion has like an emotional breakdown, which you never usually see him do. He's usually all muscle and kick ass, and he has a breakdown when Light Ray leaves, and he just lets it all out in front of Becca.
Yeah, and before that, we see that the robot that they reprogrammed blows up and takes the other robots and the station that they entered with it. So yeah, Orion's impressed, but this is where, you know, Light Ray takes his exit and Orion's without his buddy once again. So yeah, interestingly,
this is where they're testing a new technology, like a branding technology, on a Hunger Dog. They essentially take this branding iron, but I think it goes deeper than a branding iron, and put it on his chest, and then he goes running, and he pretty much does a spontaneous combustion and explodes.
Yeah, and they introduce him as Metron's mimic. And this is the first indication that what doesn't ever seem to be totally spelled out. It seems as if Metron is involved in this technology somewhat.
Yeah, there is a little bit of vagueness, mm-hmm. I think, in the Metron, like how he's playing, and also the kid that took over for Metron, who was Essek, who was he was introduced a long time ago, and that's where I got a little bit lost.
Yeah.
Everything else was pretty damn clear, but that's the part I didn't understand.
Yeah. I was looking into it a little bit, and this guy who I think he is Ethok.
Yeah, he is right. Ethok, but he turned into this evil monster, decided to go betray New Genesis. Like I get the overall story. I don't get why he did the betrayal piece. Mm. He went and betrayed New Genesis to go work for Darkseid. Yeah. And then hopefully Darkseid, I guess he wanted Darkseid to kill him. And during this time, I think he's helping invent stuff like Micromark, mm-hmm. and stuff like that, like the weapons that Darkseid's doing. And I don't know, it's just a weird vector, which we'll eventually get to, but we'll see how that pans out. It's just kind of bizarre.
Yeah, I guess that is why it's referred to as Metron's Micromark, that Ethok has used the technology, but then they basically, you know, they've kind of used him to get the technology, and then they use him as the guinea pig. And they put that mark on him, that branding, and he runs away, but explodes as if they've turned him into a living weapon of sorts. But the hunger dogs, the average people are rising up, as we see, and there's sort of military police and stuff like that trying to keep them in line with these flamethrower type weapons, but Orion is hiding amongst them and making his way closer to Darkseid's, you know, inner sanctum amidst this crowd, and as a result, you know, because of Orion's actions here, the crowd kind of gets behind him. The common people of Apokolips, they're shouting his name and sort of organizing behind his leadership in that way.
And they've never heard that kind of cheering before, on like the guys that are with Darkseid. And it's weird because then you get a scene where you get Essek, and you get some background on, you know, how he used Metron's capabilities to help Darkseid achieve his goals, and how Darkseid kind of knows, like, he's living in shame.
Mm-hmm.
You seem to have lost Metron and chosen Darkseid, and High Father would deny him, and then he mentions, like, giving him the strength to kill himself, like, he wants to die after a while. And then Darkseid gets in his little capsule ship and launches himself away before Orion could get there, because he knows his son is freaking pissed off.
Yeah, so I was mixed up. Yeah, that's right. This little dude that's all disfigured and
yeah, that's Essek.
He's Essek, and the dude that they branded earlier is just you know, one of the rabble. But yeah, Darkseid is right. Disappears just as, or takes off just as Orion arrives, and there's a lot of chaos. As Orion fights his way through, and causes a lot of destruction, and is able to confront Isak, who, at this point, you know, he's pretty much gone over to the belief in the machines, and that's part of the reason for this whole, you know, he's kind of behind a lot of the changes that have come, it seems.
He's behind Micromark.
Yeah. And, you know, he makes a statement of flesh against the machine, and puts on a respirator, because he's releasing, it seems like, a poison. This is defense against Orion.
And then you get the flashback scene that explains how he separated from Mentron, or Mentron kind of went off and did his own. Mentron's always been a loner anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Him and Lonar are very much alike.
Mm-hmm.
They're off doing their own thing. Lonar's like a guy of the past, wants to learn about the past, and Mentron's the guy who wants to always learn about the future.
Yeah.
And know more and more and more. So but they want to do it, I think, by themselves. They don't want to depend on anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And as Orion comes through, I guess that the gas didn't work as expected. Orion comes through with a pistol and fires it, and it actually hits Essek. And then he takes off his mask, and he's back to unibrow Orion, where he's, you know, his mother's son, where he starts to look more and more like Tigra. And he kind of embraces Essek and says, you know, remember who you were and go in peace and not who you became. And during that time, he turned back into his human form, like his face did, and he died.
Yeah, I think I think as we're going through this, it's making more sense to me. I think I'm following it a little bit better, but it's definitely, both times is a touching moment, and I see a little bit better now how Kirby's set Orion and Isak up as parallels to each other, you know, which is a commonly used literature technique where, you know, I mean, Orion in this case is the one that is able to overcome the circumstances that Isak is at peace at last, but, you know, we see that a lot of, it's pretty sad where, you know, Ryan points out that to Isak that ultimately he came to Apocalypse to die, and Isak admits that ultimately, yeah, it's probably true, but he was really just looking for a place to belong, and he thought maybe because the way that he looks now, he could find a place to belong on Apocalypse, or maybe thought that it was the only place that that he would belong. But and Orion, because of his life and experiences, can really identify with him, you know, sees himself in Isak's place, and as you said, as in the last moment, as Isak dies, his face returns to how it used to look. And I definitely think that this is the experience that inspires the next scene, inspires Orion to take a big step. And I think this is really where I said that, you know, you feel a sense of resolution of the story. This is a place that Orion, this is something that Kirby's been setting up all along, you know, for this character arc, at least for Orion's character, you know. This is a really important step for him where he finally lets someone see the way he really looks and shows Becca his real face. He reveals the unibrow.
he said, "This is what I really look like," and she doesn't seem to mind. He wants to tell her the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And that is cool, though, that, like you said, when I read it the first time, I didn't notice, but it is kind of like a switch between Essek and him. Like, he becomes ugly, whereas Essek becomes beautiful again. That's weird.
Yeah, and it's like the sad version. It's what could have happened to Orion.
Mm-hmm.
It makes his ultimate triumph over his situation even more powerful because we see what could have happened in Isak, and Isak has a sad ending where, you know, Ryan finally lets someone see what he really looks like, this Becca that he loves, and, you know, she loves his heart. She's seen the person that he is, so, you know, she's willing to live with the unibrow.
Right.
So
there's like explosions everywhere. I mean, and he's with Becca. Are they still on Apocalypse when he shows them his face? Yeah, I would imagine they're still there.
Mm-hmm,
but there's explosions everywhere from the Hunger Dogs blowing shit up, and I guess they can physically see New Genesis, and it was actually blown apart. All those bombs went off. High Father decided to just let them go off and let the city kind of separate itself from the planet and float off.
Yeah, and I turn the page and it's this double page splash, and when I turn the page, I just said out loud, "Oh shit!" Because it's really cool. I mean, it's really effective. It's actually a collage.
Yeah,
a big collage. It's like a skull in the foreground, as if it's exploding outward towards you. There's like someone's skull that got killed in the explosion.
It looks like there's a back of a Star Destroyer on the far left.
Yeah. but the floating city is safe, and it's really interesting because Darkseid is surprised at first, but then realizes as the people around him start to freak out that this shows the denizens of Apocalypse that, you know, they don't have a floating city to survive when, and they know that there's bombs all over their planet as well. So they realize all of a sudden, holy shit, like if Apocalypse blows up, we don't have a floating city to just as a way to survive it.
Yeah.
So they start freaking out, and this is where, you know, the people that were on the edge or whatever, this is where, like, all hell breaks loose for real, where Darkseid has totally lost the people.
Yeah, it's weird, is even though Darkseid won by destroying the planet, he ended up losing it because while he was doing all that plotting, the Hunger Dogs were destroying his own planet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, Highfather wasn't necessarily able to beat Darkseid's plan, but as Darkseid's focused on destroying New Genesis, in the process, he's lost his own planet. So he loses his own home.
And what does he do? He kind of knows that what is happening, so he gets in his little ship, which kind of like travels, I guess, in an underground fashion around the planet, and he takes it directly to where Hyman is located and his daughter and Orion, and the first thing he does is pull out his blaster and shoot Hyman, like, dead.
Yeah, it's he's lost everything, so it's almost as if he's just going to take out as many with him as he can. You know, he doesn't want to leave others to their happiness. And but Orion not only is set to escape with Becca, he's been able to, and this is another, you know, plot element that has been sitting out there, is that he was able to rescue his mother Tigra from her prison, you know, and to take her with them. So, you know, this kind of electronic door or whatever closes down, and Darkseid's pounding his fists on it as they take off, the three of them, in a capsule, this like kind of bug-like capsule-looking spaceship. And in some ways, this is one of the ways in which you see perhaps a new beginning or a plot thread for someone else to pick up, because they say, you know, as for us, adventure beckons, life beckons, the great tomorrow overture has begun. And tomorrow overture is in quotes, as if it's just like, you know, the micro mark or the anti-life equation, or it's as if it has more meaning than just a term, you know. And I really, really like these last couple panels on this page, where the way that he stages it is we see the ship going off into the distance from Darkseid's perspective, and then there's a panel of him looking up, and then the third panel is from the same thing but from farther away, so you really get this feeling of Darkseid being left alone with nothing.
Yeah.
So... Apocalypse is being, you know, destroyed, but the caption tells us that, you know, he's not dead, and that's not the end for him. As he said, it was, you know, decided to leave these characters alive. So, the caption tells us that Darkseid will likely rebuild on Apocalypse, and it's interesting the way he phrases it, his self-made prison of suspicion, hate, and murder. So we see that, you know, Darkseid's pretty much a prisoner of his own emotions and
yeah, they lost evil. A big, looks like an explosion on Apocalypse took a big chunk of the planet out.
Yeah, definitely. There's a final explosion.
But unlike New Genesis, it's still intact.
Yeah,
it just looks like
orbit.
It took about an eighth of it out.
And checking with High Father and the people in the floating city, we get a close up of the Wonder Staff.
There you go.
And it's the only comforting sight in a dark, unfriendly cosmos. So they're rallying around the staff, these New Genesis folks, and they're as well left in a place of finding a new place, perhaps. He says, what lies ahead, High Father, when someone asks. Hope, perhaps. A planet called Hope. So it's as if they're going to take their city to a new place.
And it looks like Mantron's hauling a planet right behind his, chair, his Morbius chair.
Yeah, this is an interesting last page. It's as if this is the planet that maybe they're going to put new, you know, the city on. Because he's hauling it, and it's described as a large, young, lifeless planet. But we can see from, you know, the planet itself is green and blue, like Earth, as if it's ready for, you know, it's ready and appropriate for life. It looks like as lush as New Genesis used to look. So it's, you know, there are signs of the future and possible plot threads and things to, but as far as I feel like the New Genesis saga, it's this story, you know, it's maybe not the end of Orion and Darkseid and whatnot, but it's the end of this story, you know. We get resolution of Orion's struggle with his origins. He's at peace with the fact that he, you know, with his real appearance and his real parentage, he's been able to rescue his mother and find a lover. And Darkseid, at least, this stage has been defeated and left in kind of to his own devices, to be a prisoner of himself.
Yeah, I'm glad he added the extra pages though.
Oh, definitely.
Because he added a lot of explanation in those extra pages.
Yeah, I mean, it took me kind of going through it the second time after having read it on my own with you to feel like I understood a little bit better, you know,
yeah.
even with the extra pages. So I can't even imagine how difficult it'd be tough to understand on its own or without the, you know, as it originally was written.
Mm-hmm. I think it's definitely a finale. Like, if you try to just read The Hunger Dogs without reading New Gods first, I think you'd be a little lost.
Yeah, and I think a lot of the emotional resonance would be lost, not having followed these characters through the earlier New Gods stuff. At least, if not reading Forever People and Mr. Miracle and Jimmy Olsen and stuff, at least reading the New Gods series, you know, and getting the emotional beats of where Orion is at and everything, I think would be important. But yeah, I found it to be a satisfying conclusion. I'm glad he got the chance to go back and do this. I'm glad it exists. I didn't have to wait 10 years or whatever in between.
Right.
But, so cool. Yeah, I think the way that we read this together and discussed each piece of it along the way and took our time with it, you know, over a year, I guess, to go through the four volumes, it's been a really cool and a really sort of awesome comic reading experience, you know, just to really dig into it this way. You know, it's where sometimes I'll read something on my own and read through it quickly, and then I realize a couple months later I don't really remember it that well. I feel like The Fourth World, I feel like I've really...
You understand it, yeah.
Yeah, dug in deep to it, and I think a lot of it's just going to be really... it's going to stay in my memory longer and be a reference point for me when I read other stuff. And it's been really cool to go into depth like this.
Yeah, it's awesome. I loved it. I cried. I was like, it's over. But, oh well.
I think it was a good choice for that kind of an in-depth look. It has the richness there to reward that kind of attention, you know? So, goodbye, Fourth World.
So I don't think I got any kind of questions out before the show. I like did it like a half hour.
Yeah.
We can jump into single issues if you want.
Sure. Yeah. Do you want to kick that off, or you want me to start?
Well, I'll kick it off. I think I'll start with Hex number one.
Speaking of Hex.
Well, you had mentioned that you heard bad things about it, so I thought, hey, I have it, I'll read it.
Yeah.
I liked it. Okay. The creative team on this is a creative team that we talked about a lot. At least the writer lately, the writer, the scripter, and the editing was done by Michael Fleschner. We've talked about quite a bit last episode. And then the character designs and art are by Mark Teixeira. So,
oh, okay. Yeah.
This is early like work for him. Early Mark Teixeira, like, you know, before Ghost Rider and stuff like that. And it takes place right after the conclusion of the last issue of Jonah Hex, which was, I think, 80, I don't know, it was up there. And I haven't read that issue, so I don't know how he got over here. So I guess that explains that. But as the series opens, it looks like he's in the Wild West still, like at a bar, some kind of cantina, and he wakes up and he's like, you know, what's going on? Why am I here? And one of his old nemesis walks in and starts shooting at him. And Hex takes out his six shooter and says, "You greasy fuck for holy," and then blasts him. And realizes he shot his whole torso off and that he's robotic. And he's like, "What the fuck is going on here? What in the tarnations is going on here?" And then he opens up the what do they call the saloon doors? You know, those little flappy doors. I don't know what they're called. And as soon as he opens up,
saloon doors, I think.
Yeah, you know, they're not even doors. They're like, yeah. you could see over them or you could crawl underneath them. They're just those little flappy things.
Yeah.
And he opens those doors and realizes he's on a spaceship. And there's these dudes shooting at him with like laser blasters. And then there's this bald guy that's, you know, starts talking about the past and how they're in Seattle and he's trying to find warriors from every time period, and he was chosen from the Civil War and he's a great bounty hunter and they're going to need him for this battle. And then Hex passes out and then he's in a cylinder and then Hex escapes the cylinder and then finally is able to find some six shooters in this case. And then he realizes as he walks through, there's a bunch of other like soldiers that were collected from various times throughout history that are in these cylinders being kept alive for some sort of upcoming battle. And he's breaking out, and that there's these guys with soldiers that are trying to track him down. And then it gets very Judge Dreddish, like where he sneaks out on like a radioactive like a garbage truck, except it's a garbage truck for dumping radioactive material. Mm-hmm. And he's like underneath it. He escapes. And then he ends up saving like these. And then it turns into Road Warrior, where he is in this like post-apocalyptic world where people are searching for water and stuff. And there's this scantily clad half Mohawk woman that he sees as being apprehended by three weird looking Road Warrior type people. One guy has a hook on his hand and he ends up saving her, and she takes him back to the base camp. They're going to be doing a raid. It's like a motorcycle group, these space motorcycle groups. They're called the Reapers. And Raven, I think his name is Raven. He's one of the guys that runs it, and Stiletta is the one that he met up with. And they're going to go raid a water tower because water's important, and they have this big vehicle that's going to collect the water. But somebody in their motorcycle gang had already told the group that they're going to get the water from to do an ambush because they were ready for them, and they start blasting them. And most of the motorcycle gang ends up dying except for like Raven and Hex. And Stiletta, I think, is somewhere. And then the acid rain starts. And they're like fighting during this acid rain downpour. And Hex realizes that his little Confederate uniform's like disintegrating, whereas Raven's is acid proof. So he ends up beating the crap out of Raven and taking his outfit and then getting on his bike. And then Raven ends up dying because he disintegrates in the acid rain. And then he's attacked by a futuristic helicopter. It's a pretty action-packed issue.
Nice.
It's kind of in the vein of the New 52 Hex. Because they've taken him out of the Wild West and brought him into modern times recently, so it's similar, except they jumped him into a post-apocalyptic future. Yeah. And I can just see those editors around the table, you know, sales are dropping, what can we do? Hey, I just saw Road Warrior. Let's, let's make Jonah Hex in the post-apocalyptic world.
Yeah.
And I don't know. It was interesting so far. The series ran for 18 issues, and I have the full run, so it'll be interesting to see where it goes.
Yeah, so is this the first time you've read it?
Yeah, I haven't read Hex.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting.
I know the creative team changes later on because Keith Giffen takes over.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how long Fleshner stays on board. I don't think for very long. Let me see. I guess he stays along at least for the first... He stays along for the whole series. And then the art...
Oh, okay.
The art changes from Tex Sierra to Keith Giffen on issue 15. And that's like where his... Keith Giffen's Legionnaire... I don't know if you've ever seen his Legion of Superheroes. The Great Darkness. I mean, one of those launches where they had pockets and stuff. And the characters looked really weird. It looked like Kirby-esque, but it was even more loose.
Yeah.
That's where his art style is at that particular time.
Is that like the... Something like... Was it five or a certain amount of years later, Legion or something like that?
Yeah. When all hell was breaking loose.
Yeah. So I forgot last time that before... We had the month hiatus or so that I had been reading Camelot 3000.
Yeah.
I sort of forgot that I had never finished that. So I picked it back up and I read a couple more issues, issues 8 and 9, which leaves 3 left. I think it was like a 12-issue maxi series. And when we left off before, it was... Tristan had gone to Morgan Le Fay because he wanted to turn her body back into Mal's body. As you know, originally when she got reincarnated, as everybody pretty much in the story has, in new bodies, she ended up in a woman's body, and or he ended up in a woman's body, or however you want to arrange the pronouns in that sentence. And so Morgan wants her to betray the Knights of the Round Table in order to be turned back into a man. But King Arthur thinks that someone has betrayed him. So he calls all of the knights to his throne room, whatever you want to call it. And he has all of them hold on to Excalibur, telling them that if they're telling the truth, then Excalibur will be able to reveal that, and it will kill anybody who tells a falsehood while holding on to it. So you think, because we've seen Tristan meeting with Morgan, and that... we see someone go into Merlin's room in his lab and smash this sort of like triangle talisman sort of device on the floor. It brings back, and I guess I'm not as familiar with Camelot myth and stuff. I know a lot of the broad strokes and the main characters and stuff, but this gets in a little bit more to stuff that I don't really know. I guess there's this... So when the talisman is smashed, this woman appears that's been exiled, apparently. This woman called Nineve, something like that. And... apparently Merlin has kept her away purposely, but once she appears, he's powerless against her, and he says that he's been betrayed by the only one he ever did love, and they disappear together. So Arthur finds Tristan in in Merlin's lab over top of this smashed talisman. So we think it's going to be the reveal that she's the traitor. But a number of people, different people, hold on to it and say that they haven't betrayed him, including Tristan. And then finally, when Arthur asks his brother Kay to hold on to the sword, he refuses to. And it turns out that he, in fact, actually was the traitor. And that Morgan has reached out to him as well. And that his motives actually were good in the sense that he wanted to try to stir King Arthur to action by thinking that if Merlin was taken out and was betrayed, that that would shake Arthur out of the heartache that he's been sort of trapped in ever since Guinevere and Lancelot betrayed him once again with their affair. So Arthur is about to execute Kay, even though his motives were good. He's like, you know, Arthur is a man who does everything by the books and has to follow the law no matter what.
Even though he's having the affair? Or is Lancelot having
Lancelot's having the affair with Guinevere. Okay. And that's what's caused him to be in a like a state of depression.
He doesn't know about it yet.
He does.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, last time was where when we left off last time, he had become aware of it. And, you know, put it in D&D terms for Keith, you know, Arthur is like lawful good. So
he rolled a six?
Yeah. He rolled a six, and so now he has to kill his brother. Because apparently in the future, rolling a six is even worse.
So, refresh my memory. This has been a while.
Yeah, totally.
Did he confront Guinevere?
Yeah, I had to refresh my memory as well, so... he confronted them and actually banished Guinevere and Lancelot, you know, because throughout the series so far, it's, you know, it's been will they, won't they, and they've, you know, tried to not betray him as they had once before in their previous lives, but Lancelot and Guinevere are just drawn to each other, and I think we talked about, last time I talked about Camelot 3000, I remarked in how I had discovered that this was a mature title because, you know, she drops a robe in front of Lancelot and you see her from behind.
But Lancelot still has, like, some kind of loyalty towards Arthur, right?
They're both loyal to him, yeah, except for the fact that they're in love with each other and Guinevere is supposed to be his queen, so apart
supposed
from
supposed to be,
yeah,
but they are not wed.
Right.
Okay.
Apart from their adultery, Lancelot and Guinevere still both are loyal to Arthur outside of their adultery. So, you know, even though they've been banished, when this betrayal of Arthur's brother comes to light, he's about to execute Kay. And all of a sudden, a spaceship comes flying in and shoots at Arthur, so he doesn't get a chance to. It doesn't get a chance to behead Kay as he was about to. So, Lancelot and Guinevere are still nearby, and so they join the battle. And the knights are all, you know, using the advanced weaponry that they have on them to battle at these spaceships that are coming in, and there's a moment where Arthur is about to get killed as a spaceship comes flying in from behind, and Kay is able to sort of redeem himself as him and Thomas, the boy who all the way back at the beginning of the story is the one that had originally discovered King Arthur's body and brought him back to life. They both rush in to save him, and Kay ends up taking the full brunt of the blast, but Thomas gets injured as well. And the two of them save Arthur's life, basically, where Kay gets killed and Thomas is severely injured. So Kay, as I said, gets killed, and Thomas is going to die eventually because of the radiation that he's been exposed to. But before that happens, he is knighted by Arthur and made Sir Thomas, and takes Kay's place in the Knights of the Round Table. So as we end the issue, Tristan is upset that she's been manipulated by Morgan, hasn't been given a male body. The main thrust of the following issue is that the knights want to try to cure Thomas, and Percival, the knight who is in the huge body, can't speak. He's like I forget the name of it, but he's got one of the bodies that the government at this time transforms criminals into to use as a police force. He's in the chapel praying for a vision of the location of the Holy Grail. They want to use it to save Thomas's life. And even though Thomas tells them, you know, not to delay from their real mission, Arthur insists on looking for the Holy Grail. And the other main event and reveal of this issue is that the UN official that Morgan has been working with all this time, it turns out that he's also a resurrected person from the Camelot's past. We've seen him throughout the series, but only in issue 9 is it revealed that he's actually Mordred, the bastard son of Arthur. So he has even more reasons to oppose Arthur, and we also are privy to his thoughts that he plans on betraying Morgan as well. And we see that is indeed the case as the knights split up. Some of them go to look for the Holy Grail, and Arthur and a few of the others are setting forth to continue their original mission to find and free Merlin, who's been missing because of what happened in the previous issue. So they split their forces up. We follow the group that looks for the Holy Grail, and they end up finding it because of Percival and his pure soul is able to see visions of the caretaker of the Grail, who leads them into this cave. And it's kind of a neat sequence where Percival sees all these symbols. There's like an Egyptian pyramid, an Illuminati symbol, a cross, a bunch of different things. And Lancelot's telling him to pick the crucifix, you know, because it's the Holy Grail's tied into Christian mythology and stuff. But Percival grabs this little box that's nondescript. And when he unfolds it, it's like a paper box. He unfolds it and it's in the shape of a cross. So because he chose wisely, the paper cross turns into the Grail itself, and it actually transforms Percival back into his original form as a real human man, and he's freed from his torturous existence as this creature, and disappears. So it's kind of like he's gone on to the next life, and Sir Lancelot takes over as the new guardian of the Holy Grail. So they're able to heal Thomas, but at the last minute, a new spaceship shows up, and these green alien characters attack, and they're able to wrestle the Grail away from Lancelot. So his brief career as a caretaker of it does not go very well. And it turns out that these aliens are working for the UN, the head of the new UN, who we've just found out is Arthur's bastard son. And now that he has the Grail, he's going to really be the one that's in charge of his alliance with Morgan Le Fay, because she wants to cure the disease that she's had, that we saw a few issues back, where she's got all these weird boils all over her back that she hides with her cape. She wants to drink from the Grail to heal herself, but now she has to basically do what Mordred says, if she wants that opportunity. So he's going to be the one to kind of call the shots, it seems, from here on out. So yeah, there's your treat of the complicated plots of Camelot 3000. We've got
you still enjoying it?
I am. Yeah, it took me a little bit to get back into it, but I got, you know, three more issues. I do find it very clever how it's scripted and how they're able to make it. I might not be making it sound as if it's easy to follow, but. Even though I'm not super well versed on Camelot, it's neat how it ties into stuff, but still you can enjoy it without really knowing a lot about it.
Yeah. I don't know a lot about it. I know Keith knows a lot about it.
Yeah.
That's like his wheelhouse anytime. That's why I like Demon Knight so much.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I do believe Keith has these issues. And as a fan of this series, you know, we'll just have to ask him outside the podcast, because I know he hasn't been listening since he fell asleep driving that time.
Yeah.
Or he only listens when he's trying to fall asleep, so he only hears like the first hour.
That's right.
And the rest of it just sinks into his subconscious. So we should send him subliminal messages. Keith, give me all your money. Buy me comics.
Buy me comics.
Read the new 52.
I only have two more books. I've been buying miscellaneous things on eBay uncontrollably. Getting bad again. One of the things that struck me is I ran across The Shadow. I'm a big Shadow fan lately.
Yeah.
And I ran across a couple of Batman crossovers. One nice. I haven't read yet, and one of them I have read. The one I have read is Batman 253 from 1973 by Denny O'Neil, writing it, and Irv Novak was the artist, with cover by Michael Kaluta on the cover. And this, I believe, takes place right before The Shadow was launched by DC Comics, the first one, you know, the 20-cent version of The Shadow. Mm-hmm. And it takes place in Gotham City originally, and Batman's taking down a counterfeit ring. And a couple of times while he's taking down this counterfeit ring, he's shot at. And some mysterious character saves his life, even though Batman's like, oh, that was awesome. Some marksman, I have a friend somewhere, marksman saved my life, but I would have saved myself anyway, kind of thing. But he is an amazing shooter, and he shot the guns out of the criminal's hands. And then he hears the mysterious laugh. You know how the Shadow always laughs? You know, ha ha ha.
Yeah.
And then he just goes back to the Batcave, and luckily Alfred's there, and he said, hey, you know, Alfred's tracks some of the ink that was traced to Arizona. And so Batman, this is 1973, remember, and he's rich as hell, but he decides to get to Arizona from Gotham City. Like, I guess I don't know where Gotham is, but I think it's on the East Coast somewhere. I don't know.
I think so.
And he's traveling to Arizona by bus. So that's got to be an awful experience. 1973. And he travels by bus to this one area, Tumbleweed Crossing in Arizona. And he meets up with the guy, and he's going to stay at this particular hotel with Lamont Cranston, believe it or not. And if you're a Shadow fan, you know Lamont Cranston is the Shadow.
Mm-hmm.
And a bunch of dune buggies come by, and the guy from the hotel's like, you better run inside, because these guys have been terrorizing the city every time they do that. Well, Bruce Wayne gets up in his Batman gear and knocks one dude off of a dune buggy, and the hippie guy kind of says, well, you know, I might be driving crazy, but I'm going to punch you in the face with my fists. And, you know, Batman kind of two-fists it. You know, he punches him in the gut and then bitch slaps him, and then he's out cold. And these guys say, you know, we mean no harm. Somebody's paying us $1,000 a day to come by on our dune buggies and just scare the civilians out here. And he's paying us with this, and it's $1,000, a lot of money. He said, let me see that money. I'm Batman. And he looks at the money and said, you know, this is fool's money. It's counterfeit, you know, which is why he's there anyway. It has that special ink on it or whatever. And he says, you know, this money's not worth shit. And he said, I'll let you guys go. You guys got to have to leave town immediately. And these guys were also paid to stay away from the Indian ruins. So he's like, I wonder if these counterfeiters are up in the Indian ruins. And then he has dinner with Lamont Cranston, who he doesn't know is the Shadow, and decides to get into a Jeep and drive out to the Indian ruins, where these snipers end up shooting his Jeep's tire and knocking him off the road. And then a helicopter comes by and draws the fire away from him, and then Batman takes out the gunman. And then you get a nice two-page spread of 8 tracks. Back in the day, we used to have like things called like Columbia House and stuff like that, where you could get like 10 CDs or 10 tapes or 8 tracks for like 99 cents. And then you're part of a club for 3 years and you had to order 10 at regular.
Yep, been there, done that numerous times.
This one here is like... 6 LPs or 5 tapes for 99 cents. And, you know, we got some Steely Dan and Led Zeppelin, Houses of the Holy, and Elton John, Don't Shoot Me, I'm Only a Piano Player. All 8 tracks and tapes. It's weird. I used to have an 8-track player. But not to get distracted. back to our Batman tale. He takes out the gunman, and then you hear the weird laughter coming from that funky-looking helicopter. So the Shadow was driving that, and he kind of drove the attention away from the gunman so Batman could take it out. Makes his way to the Indian ruins, sees that the money's being printed there, and then proceeds to attack the counterfeiters. One of the counterfeiters gets taken out immediately, the guy with the gun. The other counterfeiter takes a bucket of ink and throws it into Batman's face, and he's like, oh, that's the price of overconfidence. And he's like, my eyes are burning. And the other guy gets in a plane and it looks like he's going to escape, but then the Shadow shows up and he's got his 2 pistols and he just starts blasting the plane, and the plane like flips. It does like a 180-degree flip right over itself and crashes and catches on fire, and Batman rescues the dude. And the dude actually is in a paranoia because he starts talking about the Shadow, you know, staring at me, staring holes into my skull. Like he's like terrified of the Shadow. And then he tells him that the lead counterfeiter is really the hotel guy that, you know, Bruce Wayne was staying with. So, you know, Batman goes back and confronts the lead counterfeiter, And that guy's pretty brave. He just pulls out like this Dillinger and is ready to shoot Batman. And then the Shadow actually shoots out the light. And then Batman takes out the counterfeiters. And then justice is served. And then there's a little handshake. And I guess Batman idolizes the Shadow. He's like, you're my biggest inspiration. I'd be honored to shake your hand. And he's like, the honor is mine. And then the Shadow just takes off into the... And then it says, come check out his own magazine in mid-September. So, yeah, it was pretty cool.
Nice.
Only the Shadow knows. I love the Shadow. So I want to, like, seek out as much Shadow as I can get.
Yeah, I think the Shadow and Batman are neat characters to play off each other.
Yeah.
Because they're kind of, there's similarities there, and it reminds me of that Batman the Animated Series episode. I think it's not the Shadow, but it's a similar, like, I think it's called the Gray Ghost or something like that. It's one of the better episodes of the cartoon, but where it's kind of like the Shadow or one of those, it's a new hero,
it's,
but it's supposed
to be from
that. It's a knockoff
of the Shadow kind of thing.
Yeah, where it's a hero that Bruce Wayne watched on TV or on the radio or whatever when he was growing up and is inspired by, and he ends up interacting with the actor that portrayed the character and stuff. But it's kind of neat how the whole idea of a Batman being inspired by the pulp era heroes and stuff. The other thing that I was going to talk about is just, firstly, in general, the Marvel has been putting out this new line of the Epic Collection. There's three of them out so far. There's another one coming out soon. I decided to try one out and then see how I liked it, and then I picked up the other two that are out. And I mean, in some ways, it's kind of interesting because, you know, the whole thing with these is that they're, so far, it seems like planning on, they have plans to put out ones of Amazing Spider-Man, Avengers, Captain America, Fantastic Four, Iron Man, and Thor. So, and I remember reading somewhere that they, right now, they're not planning any, like, X-Men type collections just because there's a lot of that stuff traded already. And essentially these are supposed to, in the long run, whether they ever get there or not, it's hard to say, but these are supposed to end up being a full collection of the comic.
From beginning to end, kind of like the Chronicles?
Yeah.
I never heard of them.
So like I said, yeah, they just started coming out a couple months ago, and but the way they're doing it is, so they're trade paperbacks, but they're full color. The paper is kind of I like the paper. It's kind of it's not real glossy, but it's got, you know, the recoloration, so it looks real good and stuff. And the first one that came out was Iron Man. And what's kind of neat is that the spines all look the same, but the spine doesn't have the volume number on it. So if you like have them on your shelf and you're not going to collect all of them or something like that, it just looks like, you know, an Iron Man trade with a, and they give the collection a title. This first one's called The Enemy Within. But then if you flip to the back, on the back cover, it has the volume number, and this happens to be volume 10, because they made the decision to not release them from volume 1 going forward, because a lot of that early stuff has been, you know, traded and made available. They decided to publish them out of order and publish, focus on at first stuff that's not available in trade format. Or, you know, sections of these runs that aren't available in trade format, but they must have sat down and broken up the whole run, decided, you know, where the volumes were going to fall ahead of time, or at least I'm assuming that they did. So the Iron Man one, it covers Iron Man 158 through 177 in annual 5, and so it's, you know, presented in publication order. And so presumably when, you know, volume 11 is released, it'll butt up and right against this and start with Iron Man 178, but like I said, they're not released in order, so the next one that they're releasing for Iron Man, which will come out at the beginning of next year sometime, is called War Games, and it's actually volume 16. So it's an interesting approach, but I think it's kind of smart, sort of makes sense, and it's kind of cool that this, you know, the stuff that they're releasing so far is stuff that's, you know, I assume that this stuff's probably on Marvel Unlimited, but not necessarily in a reasonably priced trade. And so speaking of which, the price ranges from it's either $35 or $40 so far, it seems, and I think it depends on, they're all kind of roughly the same size, but I think they might vary a little bit. Like, this first Thor volume is, like, 460-something pages. And that was $35 cover price. And Iron Man and the third volume, the one that just came out, Spider-Man, is closer to 500 pages, and those are the $40 price. But obviously you can get them closer to $27.
Are they out?
Yeah, so far the Iron Man one I just talked about is out. Thor, War of the Pantheons, which is volume 16 from 1987 through 1989. It collects Thor 383 through 400. I haven't started reading that one yet, because I skipped ahead to the one that just came out, which is Amazing Spider-Man Cosmic Adventures. It's volume 20, 1989 to 1990.
Hmm.
What's interesting about this is it's Amazing Spider-Man, but it looks like they're going to pull in issues from Spectacular and Web when it's relevant. So it has, because it has, in publication order, it has three issues of Spectacular Spider-Man, three issues of Web of Spider-Man mixed in, and then it has like six or seven issues of Amazing Spider-Man, and then it has the annuals of all three. And what's interesting is last time we were talking about that question of favorite storylines from annuals, and I didn't realize until I got this that that Spidey's Tiny Adventure storyline is actually is the three annuals that's collected in the back of this book.
Oh.
So, right after talking about it, I have it right here. And some of the Amazing Spider-Man issues that are in here, this covers the time period where Eric Larson took over. So, like, the first Amazing Spider-Man issue that you have in here is was a fill-in by Colleen Duran. And then you get an Eric Larson's first issue.
I just wish they'd do that with the omnibuses and just keep going. I mean, for me personally, because that's what I decided to invest in. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I hear you.
I just, why stop? Just keep going.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe they thought with some of
I just don't like stuff. The mix and match. Like, I think this way is assuming that, hey, you could go get the Marvel Masterworks up to this point and then jump into these trades, but then you could have a mismatch of formats. Do you know what I mean? Hardcover and then trade, or I don't know. It's weird.
No, I totally hear you, and I think that that's one of the complaints that some people have. I mean, it's ideal for someone like me who doesn't have any of the Masterworks and doesn't have the Omnibuy and stuff. I mean, it seems like the stuff they're going to collect first, because, and that's part of the reason maybe that they decided not to go in order, and to collect some of the stuff that hasn't been collected. But like you said, yeah, I mean, it's frustrating if you don't want to mix formats and stuff. I bought the Iron Man one first to see.
See if you liked it, and you said, "Oh, this is for me."
And I just like the size. It's a chunky volume, but it's not so huge that it's uncomfortable to hold in your hands. And you know, you get a good amount of material to read, and it's in order. And you know, I think a lot of the stuff, like I said, is on Marvel Unlimited, which I do have a subscription to, but just having these on the shelf and be able to grab one and pick it up and read through it and have everything already set out in order for me, and the way that they've, you know, have these matching spines, and how you can like sort of flip over the back and see what volume it is and what time period it covers. And it doesn't, they don't have a lot of extras.
Sounds cool. I just would like it to be more like the Chronicles. Like even DC hasn't released a Chronicle in forever.
Yeah.
So it's like, yeah, I understand maybe the sales aren't worrying it, but damn it, I already invested this far. I want to keep going.
No, I totally hear you. I totally agree with the Chronicles. It's like, you know, I got the four Flash ones that have come out, and Volume 5, I don't know if they'll ever do one, and it's still, and Volume 5 would still cover books that are a bit too expensive for my pocketbook, you know, so
yeah.
Hopefully we'll see it eventually. But yeah, I mean, as far as these go, I mean, I don't know, like, will they really end up collecting all six of these series from start to finish? I don't know, but fortunately, because of the way that they're doing it, if they don't, or if I sort of lose interest and don't want to keep buying them, it seems like they're putting one out, like one out a month right now.
I want to look at them, but I don't want to cause my recorder to have any issues, so I don't want to bring up a browser.
Yeah, I mean, if I guess, so what I was going to say is just that it's nice that when you look at them on the shelf, it's not just like volume 20. Like, you can't really see that it's volume 20 until you pull it off the shelf and look at the back.
Yeah.
And they did that purposely for people that didn't necessarily want to collect them, all of them. Like, say you just want a trade of the storyline that, or the, you know, the range of Spider-Man that this collects, or those Iron Man issues or something, then, you know, you could just buy it and put it on its shelf. So it gives me a little bit of a reassurance that if I lose interest, you know, I won't feel like I have an incomplete set or something. Maybe. I'll know it in my head, but at least on my shelf.
Well, you don't have that collector mentality, I don't think, do you?
Not too. Well, I do, but I've put a lot of time into breaking some of the habits. Like, I've spent a lot of time working on my habits already.
Yeah.
And I do definitely still have it. I'm still working on it, but I don't know. These are just cool. I mean, they look cool next to each other, the three that I have. Even though it's just one, you know, it's a one Spider-Man, one Iron Man, one Thor. Like, the formatting of the spine is the same. It's just the colors that's different. So, like, the lettering and the little icon at the bottom that has Spider-Man in it is red. Blue in Thor's case and yellow in Iron Man's case.
Uh-huh.
So the next one that comes out, I think it actually comes out next week, is the first Avengers one, and that's Volume 9, and it's called The Final Threat. So then they got a Captain America one coming, a Fantastic Four one coming, and then it looks like they're going to kind of go back through the rotation again.
Guess I haven't paid attention to them in the previews.
Yeah, they've been soliciting one in each previews, it looks like.
I have to go back and look.
Like the
just
new,
to see what they look like and what they have in them.
Yeah, the new preview.
Personally, yeah, I'm interested in a lot earlier than the frame that that they're printing them, because mm-hmm. I have most of that in single issues.
Right.
But it would be interesting if they did something more with the Bronze Age stuff that mm-hmm. is more in color and available.
Yeah, I think this Avengers Final Threat, this one that's coming out, I think might be the earliest of the stuff so far. Just looking up here on Amazon if it says what it is, because it's Avengers 150 through 166, Annuals 6 and 7, Supervillain Team-Up number 9, and Marvel 2-in-1 Annual number 2.
Hmm.
That's kind of interesting collection there, but it's like Jim Shooter, Jerry Conway, George Perez, Jim Starlin, John Byrne are some of the creators that are mentioned on the cover. Yeah, so it's an interesting line. We'll see how it goes. It's almost like, I think maybe it's kind of what they're doing instead of Essentials now. And you got the color, so it's kind of nice that it's in color.
Yeah.
We'll see. We'll see how long I stick with it. But yeah, it looks like once they... And you also bring up another issue with it too. It's like when the Fantastic Four one comes out, that'll be the first one that I have a bulk of the issues.
Right.
So that'll be the first time I really have to ask myself that question. Like do I want to double dip in this way?
Mm-hmm.
So
that's when your collector mentality will see how strong you are.
Yeah.
We'll see if the force is strong with this one.
Yeah, that's usually a thing that I'm pretty good about is it's like, nope, I have those in issues, or nope, I have that trade.
I'm weak.
But
I am the weakest one.
We'll see though.
It's like kryptonite.
Yeah.
I fall to my knees and hit the order button.
Please help me. Oh, so yeah, I mean, I guess so. That was my. I mean, I read the Iron Man volume.
The whole volume?
Yes, yeah, I've had that one a little while.
158 to 177.
Yeah. So I finished that one like a week or two ago, and then I've started the Spider-Man one. But it was pretty cool. I mean, I'm not very well versed in Iron Man. Wasn't a favorite of mine when I was a kid. I just haven't read a lot of Iron Man. I've read, when it comes to Marvel stuff, I've read more Spider-Man and X-Men stuff. So those were my favorites. So this is pretty cool. I mean, this is an era, this kind of covers the era where it's mostly written by Denny O'Neil, and a lot of the art is by Luke McDonald. And Tony Stark ends up about halfway through back on the bottle. And by the end of the volume, I mean, he's in really rough shape. He's living on the street. His company's been taken over. And he's homeless, basically. And Rhodey is taken over as Iron Man. So that was only... That's one thing that's kind of interesting about the format is that when it ends, I mean, that's still where things are standing. You know, when you get to the end of issue 177, I mean, Tony Stark is still living on the street and is still on the sauce, and Rhodey is still Iron Man. So there's
I have that cover in my database. It's the Epic Collection, you said?
Mm-hmm.
The Enemy Within?
Yep.
That's interesting.
Yeah, so it's kind of... What was funny is that I actually happened to have issue 178. I just randomly got it, like, in a, you know, out of a dollar bin or a 50-cent bin. And I don't have, like, 179 or 180. I mean, I think the next issue I have is, like, 199 or 200 or something like that. So I couldn't really continue the story for very long. But since I had actually had 178, I just grabbed it and read it because it was the next issue right after the collection. So it's kind of funny, but it was they used to do that assistant editor's month.
Yeah.
Where things would be real wacky. So half of it's this story about this group of kids that, dress up as Avengers and the one that's Iron Man, dresses up as Iron Man, gets kicked out of the club because they think that he betrayed him or something. And then the second story is touching base with homeless Tony Stark. But they don't really, I mean, they don't, Denny O'Neill doesn't pull punches in this. Like, he definitely does a good job of depicting alcoholism. And like at one point, Rhodey takes Tony, picks him up in the Iron Man armor and flies him to Philadelphia to Rhodey's mom's house. And he leaves Tony under his mom's care and comes back later, and Tony had stolen Rhodey's mom's cooking wine and like chugged the whole thing and then escaped out the bathroom window to go get more alcohol. So he's like in really rough shape in the latter half of this collection. And I just was like wondering what it would be like to read, like be a kid reading this and learning about alcoholism. But they don't.
I read it as a kid.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's good that you don't glamorize it. You know, you really, if you were a kid, you'd grow up realizing that alcoholism is not a good thing.
Matter of fact, these issues that you're talking about, I have all the way through 177.
Nice.
And I picked them all off the spinner rack. They all look familiar to me.
Yeah. Yeah, when I started reading comics, I think like Iron Man was in the 200s. I had a couple of them, but didn't have too many.
Yeah.
But I like Rhodey Iron Man. Rhodey's cool.
Yeah, he had to step it up because Tony was failing and everything.
I mean, I like superheroes, you know, so even though they struggle with who they are and stuff, and, like, Rhodey really, like, he's very heroic in how he steps up and tries to help out his friend, and, like, he's working with the scientist that, and when Tony's company's taken over, the guy that takes over it is trying, he wants the Iron Man armor, and there's this really cool issue where they stage this sequence where they, where Rhodey has to break into Tony's lab all the old Iron Man armors are stored. Mm-hmm. And he has to get in there and rescue all of Tony's equipment and stuff before, you know, meanwhile the guy that's taken over Tony's company is trying to break in through the front door with these machines and stuff. And Rhodey, you know, is able to get all the Iron Man armor away from the guy that's taken over the company, and like everyone starts quitting that's loyal to Tony, you know, the guy that took over the company, he's has to like hire all new people and stuff.
Yeah,
it's pretty cool, but it's interesting because, you know, Tony's not available. He's drunk all the time, so he's not available to teach Rhodey how to use the armor and stuff, so he kind of has to figure out on his own with the help of the scientist. They make a pretty neat team working together, the Rhodey and the scientist. And so I guess I'm becoming a Rhodey. Rhodey was one of my favorite things about Iron Man 3. I wanted to see more Rhodey in that as Iron Patriot, so I guess I'm becoming a James Rhodes fan. He's cool.
Right on. So for this one, do you just want me to show the cover of the trade or all issues?
I mean, just the cover of the trade is cool because
okay,
just talked about it in general and
maybe I'll put
the collections and stuff.
Does that have a 10 next to it? Book 10 or no?
Yeah, I think it is volume 10. Let me look on the back of it.
That's interesting.
Yep, volume 10.
So the way my database is tracking it, it has a book 9. But book 9 covers, like, issues. Oh, that's a weird one. 258.1 to 258.4. And then, like, book 8 is 258 to 266. That's Armor Wars Part 2. I don't know. It's just weird the way they're cataloging it.
Yeah, it must be like I don't know.
It's like they're taking all the trades and categorizing them as books. Like, it's bizarre.
Yeah, because the next Iron Man one is called War Games, and it's actually volume 16. It's supposed to come out in April of next year, and that covers 258 through 277.
Hmm.
That's the next one that they're actually going to put out.
Yeah.
So I guess if you really want to sit down with a piece of paper, you could probably figure out what's going to be in the volumes in between, like 11 through 15. But if anyone does that, let me know.
All right. So the last book that I read, I also got off of eBay. And this one falls into the Bronze Age, which I've been attacking aggressively lately. Doctor Strange number one. And it is by, let's see, Steve Englehart is the writer, and artist is Frank Bruner. And I love this one. So I kind of attacked these in the order that I liked them. Mm-hmm. And Doctor Strange was the one. Marvel Bronze Age, man, they were doing all kinds of crazy shit. I like it.
Yeah.
And I'm a DC dude, but
I definitely get that sense.
Really like what I'm reading about the Marvel Bronze Age. So this story was from this is the second volume, I believe, because the first volume I think took off from Strange Tales and then kept renumbering. So Strange mm-hmm. Tales I think featured Nick Fury, and then the second part was Doctor Strange, and then Doctor Strange went off into his own book, and the numbering kept on continuing. Mm-hmm. And that was volume one, and this is volume two. And even though it says volume one, I want to call it volume two because it just depends who you talk to.
Yeah.
In the indices, it says volume one. So this is from 1974. This is like when I really like books, 73, 74. Doctor Strange is in his Sanctum Sanctorum or whatever they call it, and he's hanging out, and Clea shows up, and at this time Clea is his like girlfriend and also his mentee. In other words, he's training her in the ways of magic, and this continues from Marvel Premiere number 14. And he feels at this time that he's been neglecting Clea in terms of keeping her up on her studies, as he's been concentrating on other stuff that's happening in the mystic realms. And she's just learning the basics, so she pulls a rabbit out of a hat. And Wong is still around. He shows up and talks to her. But there's this weird, interesting, awkward scene where he says, "Let me show you later the Visanti and the deck of cards, and I'd be happy to see it later." And there's this scene that he's like, "Okay, we're going to go make love now, okay?" And it's like in grayscale, and his cape is like floating above him when he comes back out, and Wong comes in, and he goes, "Wong, I must sleep." Like he had ejaculated, now he needs to go to sleep. "Prepare the mists of Morpheus, and then clean my cloak of Leviathan, if you will." I wonder what he did on his cloak. I wonder what kind of sexual juices are on his cloak. But then there's
maybe Leviathan himself.
Yeah,
it reminds me actually the issue of Avengers that I covered in the new myth making, etc., that I recorded. Mm-hmm. There's this sequence where Absorbing Man absorbs liquid, and then he just throws his entire self all over Titania. <I'm just> like, I mean, he does it as a way to get Ant-Man's bugs all off of him, off of her. But I'm just thinking about, like, he essentially threw his entire being all over her.
For her. Here, take like, that.
That's really taking things to another level there, man.
Yeah. He started off with the Doctor Strange in this case started off with the clean cloak, and then he had some sex and he's like, "Hey Wong, can you get this clean for me?" And then Clea is there. You know how the Sanctum Sanctorum or wherever they hang out in that has that circular glass window that you always see. Mm. Doctor Strange's room. Well, there's some strange figure out there that's hanging out watching Clea pet her rabbit. And he essentially uses magic to turn that rabbit into like this 12-foot red-eyed rabbit that from hell that breaks out the window. And Clea's like, oh shit, I created a rabbit. I need to, that's going to endanger people. And then everybody saw this rabbit crash out of the house. I need to go outside of Greenwich Village and capture that rabbit. And then this guy's name is the Silver Dagger. He kind of is like a bald headed dude. He looks old, bald headed dude with like a cool mustache. And it probably looks like he's in his 50s. And he hypnotizes Clea and takes control of her body. And he's there for a purpose. And then Wong comes in and he's like, holy shit, he's got control of Clea. And then he brings up his kung fu. And this guy like out kung fus him and beats the shit out of him. And then he steals the eye of Armamoto. And then there's an alarm on it. So two of the alarms go off to tell Doctor Strange, hey, somebody stole me. And the Silver Dagger imagines to stop those warnings. And then while Doctor Strange is in his trance, because he just had a couple orgasms and he's exhausted, the Silver Dagger attacks him and sticks a dagger right in his back. Poof! So you're like, oh shit, he killed Doctor Strange. And Wong comes in, and then he takes Clea outside the window, and he's like using her as a slave. And then Wong comes in, and so he's like, Master, he's dead. And then he's like, you know, you need, if you get the eye of Agamotto, I can cure, and Clea, I can tell her what spell to use on me and heal me. And he's like, well, sorry, sir. The Silver Dagger just took Clea and the Eye of Agamotto. And he's like, holy shit. He says, well, get me my cloak. Maybe I can do something. So he uses the cloak and the orb to try to heal himself. And he gets sucked into this weird world where there's this strange caterpillar. And, you know, it's inside of his cape. And I guess once you get in there, you can never get out of the orb. And that's how it ends. He's stuck in his orb trying to heal himself and escape. And he can't get out.
Hmm.
But it was so much fun, the art. I loved it.
That's one
lesson learned is don't go have an orgasm when you're going to be attacked. Because all your defenses are down.
Makes you tired.
Makes you tired.
Take off your cloak first. Yeah, that's definitely would be a sucky part of the assistant job.
Yeah, he's like, clean all this crap off my cloak.
I gotta clean your cloak again.
What are you doing? And then Wong is like, why does it smell like sex?
What are you doing with this thing?
What are you doing with this cloak? What's this sticky stuff?
Did you spill glue all over this, or what happened?
So, yeah, that was Doctor Strange number one.
Cool. Yeah, that's a series that Back Issue magazine has made me want to read. This old Doctor Strange, because I never read any of that stuff, and it sounds awesome.
Yeah, I'm reading the same back issue one that you were reading, and I have all the Defenders, but I don't have all of the one thing that's awesome about back issue is it tells you like sequentially, oh, you should check out Marvel Team Up because it followed this storyline, or you know, I might not have all the Marvel Team Ups or the Doctor Strange issues that led up to Defenders, so
yeah,
seeking those out now. So back issues, I mean, there's some weeks where if I didn't have so much new books coming in, I would just sit and read old books.
Yeah.
Because this shit is freaking like, I don't know, especially the Bronze Age stuff. I just get like so into it. I think it's because that's what I grew up with. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it takes me back and puts me in a familiar place. And I didn't read a lot of Bronze Age Marvel. I was a DC dude. So a lot of this is new to me.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of like why I have so much, so many DC comics from the 80s. Because when I want something that's new but has that feel, I mean, there's some similarity in the feel to it as the 80s Marvel stuff that I read. But it's new to me. So, I mean, but that's kind of like my comic book life right now is reading old stuff. It's basically all I do right now.
Yeah.
Not that'll always be the case necessarily, but that's what I'm enjoying doing right now for the time being.
But I switched gears. I'm back into the modern age now, and I'm reading Lady Sif and Journey into Mystery, getting caught up there, and that's really entertaining. So I keep flip-flopping. I have disorders.
Yeah. I flip-flop. I guess I think I just don't as frequently.
I wish I would stay more focused because I would have a lot more complete runs. But my last purchase was... it was very strategic and goal-oriented to complete my Jonah Hex and Hex runs. And I completed my Malibu stuff for the most part. A bunch of independent runs. So, yeah. Independent-wise, I think I've completed everything that I want to complete. Valiant and... Well, I have one issue that is haunting me, and it's so damn expensive, and it's so current that, and so rare. It was the Shadow Man Volume 3 from Acclaim right before they went bankrupt. They went bankrupt, and then they shipped out one last release, and a lot of comic stores canceled their orders, so they didn't, because they knew they went bankrupt. And then the book shipped, and my shop didn't get it, even though I had it on my pull list, and never got it, never thought to go get it, because I didn't know it existed, right? Because I thought the company went under, and found out it did exist, and when I found out it did exist, it was already a couple hundred dollars. It's actually worth more than the old stuff, so it's like, what the hell? Those last two books that were published when they went under are the most valuable Valiant books. It's weird.
Yeah.
Unity 2000 number 3 and Shadow Man.
The scarcity of it.
Yeah.
It sucks. Yeah, I mean, it haunts you so much that I know that that's the one that you're missing.
Yeah.
What's one final thing I was going to mention I haven't gotten to yet in this Spider-Man volume, but it actually has the I did mention that it has the start of Eric Larson on Amazing Spider-Man.
Yeah.
And so as a result, it has the very first issues I got in my Amazing Spider-Man mail subscription that I had for a little while when I was a kid. It was definitely my favorite comic for a while when Eric Larson was drawing it.
I went into shock when Eric Larson drew it. And it's because I love the Michelinie McFarlane stuff.
Yeah.
And then it drastically changed. But I swear to you, after about 10 issues, I was sucked into the Eric Larson, realm. And I followed him into Savage Dragon, and that's another series that I'm about 5 issues away from completing a full run of Savage Dragon.
Nice.
So, yeah. I have a lot of comics.
Well, the funny thing is for me that nowadays, it kind of flip-flops for me. I actually, Eric Larson's art holds up better for me than McFarlane's.
I think it does for me too, but there's more of it.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I mean, McFarlane, man. If you look at, I mean, after he left Spider-Man and then went on to Spawn, he left Spawn quick, man. Mm-hmm. I mean, he basically handed over his reins to Tony Daniel or Capullo.
Yeah.
And then said, "Well, I'll script it, but that's all I'll do." And I really don't understand that. Like, unless his hand, he stopped being able to draw correctly or something, or there's some injury that I just don't know about. He just kind of just stopped.
I mean, I guess it's possible. I guess, I mean, from what he said publicly, though, is, and Eric Larson has said that, I mean, I remember Eric Larson in an interview was explaining how him and McFarlane just had different goals in mind when they started Image, that with their properties. I mean, McFarlane wanted to create Spawn as a character that would take off on its own, and you know, that he was planning on giving up full control over it. And
the Jack Kirby thing, like, it sounds like that's what he wanted to do.
Yeah, whereas, you know, Eric Larson created Savage Dragon with the intention that as long as he was around, he was going to just create this long, ongoing comic that never really ended.
Yeah.
That he controlled and did everything on his own. That was what he wanted to do. So, yeah, it's a different kind of approach. But, yeah, I mean, it's interesting just, like, flipping through this volume, because it does have, it has Eric Larson's first issue that he did, which, you know, was 327. And it also has, because he did that, and then there was one more McFarlane issue, so it also has McFarlane's last issue, which was the next one, 328.
Yeah.
Which is the one with, because when this, the first half of this book is all Acts of Vengeance stuff.
Yeah.
So this is the one with the Gray Hulk getting punched in the gut.
Mm-hmm.
By Spider-Man on the cover. So, and yeah, I mean, as I kind of flip through this, I mean, I don't not like McFarlane, but
it doesn't hold up as well for you.
Yeah,
today as Eric Larson.
When I was a kid, though, there was nothing we wanted more than to get our hands on McFarlane issues, because we came along like right sort of at the end there, and those prices had already skyrocketed.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember buying, I think it was like 312 or something like that for, like, you know, it was like $14 or something. And I had to save my allowance and everything to get the money for that.
Yeah.
But yeah, these Larson issues were the ones that were actually coming out, and then I was getting in the mail subscription, and the way that he drew Mary Jane was definitely a part of my transition into manhood.
Oh, did you make a mess of your cloak?
I think might have made a mess of my comics. I don't know. I don't have those, the original issues that I had anymore.
You traded them? Traded them away. Why do these pages stuck together?
Why is this panel cut out?
I can't finish these stories.
Yeah. Jim Lee was pretty good at drawing the ladies then too.
Yeah, I was just gonna say most of those Image guys really started at DC first. Liefeld started on Hawk and Dove. McFarlane started on Infinity Inc.
And Larson started
on Doom Patrol.
Doom Patrol. Yeah.
There you go. Like, I don't think Jim Lee did. I think Jim Lee was not a DC guy. I mean, he ended up at DC.
Yeah.
And whilst Portasio or guy that didn't produce a lot of material, I don't remember him being on DC at all, or Valentino.
No, Valentino was the one. I bought Shadowhawk, that's what it was called, right? When that came out. but I didn't really. Guardians of the Galaxy was what he was doing at Marvel before Image started, and I didn't really. That didn't really catch my interest as a kid, so I wasn't really familiar with that.
I have that full run. I just can't find it. I think it's in the basement somewhere.
Mm.
But
he was kind of the only one, though, because when Image started, I was like, oh my, like, it was just like all of my favorite artists were the ones that were leaving. So I totally lost interest in Marvel because I was all about the art. But I only, and then it was only like a year or two into Image starting when I stopped with comics altogether. But at first I was like, well, I guess I'm just going to buy Image comics now.
Yeah. I started comics roughly around 1973, and it was all about the art. And then I really learned to read really well, and then it inverted itself a little bit.
Yeah.
And now it's totally inverted. It's like I can adapt to art where I cannot adapt to a bad story, at least in my opinion. Like, everybody might think a story is good that I don't, but
right.
What I like.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
So
we have a plan for the next thing that we're going to tackle, but we're probably just going to surprise you next episode.
Yeah, we can keep it a secret.
Yeah, keep it a secret.
What we're replacing Fourth World with?
Mm-hmm.
Or following it up with, I should say.
Yep.
The new content we both... Yeah, because I definitely like that balance of having something that we've both experienced.
Right.
And then, you know, combining that with stuff that we've done on our own.
I'm really interested to see if you'll make it
through to the next conclusion.
Yeah, because it is kind of a timepiece, a mm-hmm. time capsule.
Well, so I'm going in with that
frame of mind.
I am going in with that expectation because that is something that I've read. So
yeah.
So that should help, and I'm pretty open to that. You know, I mean, I've been. I'm usually pretty good about not expecting things from the past to be like made like they were brand new. You know, 2013 kind of thing. So
mm-hmm.
probably because I spend so much of my time. You know, not only reading stuff from the past, but also a lot of times watching TV and stuff like that from earlier generations.
Yeah.
So.
All right. So that wraps up an episode of Retrocast. You can reach us on Twitter at MythMakingETC. That's Chris. Or me at Mike Myers Brunch. Our webpage is on geekbrunchpodcast.com. You can also find Geek Brunch Podcast on Facebook and click the like button and follow us there. You can leave us an iTunes review. And if you do leave an iTunes review, because we share the feed with Geek Brunch proper, if you could just say it's for Retrocast, we'd appreciate it. We'd like that for Christmas. And what else?
You can email us, mike@comicbooknoise.com or mythmakingetc@gmail.com. If you don't already know, my mini podcast, which should, as I speak, episode 8 is the newest one. I've been releasing them on Sunday, but I'm going to release another episode this Thursday and switch the release date of Thursdays. For as much as it matters, so you can check that out if you want to hear me ramble some more.
Now that the weather's getting better, I'm going to start listening. I usually listen when I'm doing things like chores or walking Harley, and haven't been listening to a lot of podcasts just because the temperatures have been so damn low.
Well, in your ear issue.
Yeah, my ear. I'm hearing. I can actually hear you in my bad ear. That's how good it's gotten. That's but it's like, if I had to say where it's at volume, though, like mm-hmm. if I compare it with my Goodyear, you're probably coming in at 40%, maybe, you know, somewhere near 50% of the volume of my Goodyear.
Yeah.
But I can at least hear you. I can comprehend you.
Yeah. Well, by comprehending me, you've already made progress beyond
yeah,
that of some
people. Yeah, because
before
I couldn't hear at all.
Yeah.
Before I could just hear beeps and noises. And I think that's why my brain is freaking out and my surround sound is really freaking out.
Well, I just mean some people who have 100% hearing can't comprehend me sometimes. So,
like Keith, because he's usually asleep.
Yeah.
He's driving to work. He's hitting the rails.
My dulcet tones are just soothing him to sleep. Rock-a-bye, Keith.
All right. Well, you have... are you taking any time off or no?
Yeah, actually, I took tomorrow off, and then we're closed Tuesday, Wednesday, so I don't go back to work till Thursday. So
I'm off for 2 weeks, but
nice.
I have to work at least one day this week or next week
mm-hmm.
just to get some things closed out that I didn't finish last week.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking I can do it in maybe 6 hours. If I get left alone, and everybody thinks I'm on vacation, so I just have to make sure I appear offline so nobody bothers me, and I should be able to get it done in 6 hours and then leave. But yeah, so I'll be reading a lot. I haven't been reading a lot this week or last week, but I'll be back up to my standard numbers.
Nice.
Next week.
Yeah, I guess if we record 2 weeks from now, it'll be 2014.
Yeah.
So.
Well, thank you for joining me on this podcast and that fourth world journey. It was really a blast. And we went through, I mean, those things are thick. And we went through 4 volumes of it. Plus the Flash Chronicles.
Yeah. Like I was saying, it feels like an accomplishment. It was actually, I mean, it definitely was one of the better comic book reading experiences I've had.
Yeah, I want to...
The way that we went about it.
I almost want to, with that afterword, I almost want to jump into Commandy now.
Yeah.
Or the Demon, because it's timely. But I'll see what I do.
I know. I've thought about that too, because I have I don't have all of the stuff that they've put out of his, but I do have Demon and I have Commandy Volume 1 and 2.
Yeah.
On my shelf. I haven't read them yet.
It's good stuff.
Yeah.
I've read Commandy. Mm-hmm. I haven't read all the Demon. I've read a good chunk of it, but I missed a bunch of stuff, a bunch of issues here and there. I have them all now in singles, but I'll read definitely the omnibus because it's in order and all that.
Yeah.
All right. Well, you have a good holiday and a happy new year.
Yeah, you too. Talk to you next year.
Yeah, I still have some questions for you about our next project, but I'll just send them to you over Facebook or something.
Sounds good. We don't want to give out any more clues.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'll talk to you later.
All right. Sounds good. Bye.